sold 100,000 of previous book, and this one they were printing 7,000.
Yes, yes. But still, the novel writing, sort of what we may call the realistic novel writing, mm-hmm. or memoirs, is still more popular mm-hmm. than poetry or essays, which is harder to read. And,
I was at the reading last night and you received a warm reception. And do you enjoy public performances? Do you find that they're part of the life of the poem, or are they a kind of afterthought?
I have great difficulties with your expression enjoy. We have uh-huh. no translation for the word. So basically I may say I enjoy it, I like it. Not as that when I get the best way of how to spend my time. Mm-hmm. Maybe get a, figure out the poem, mm-hmm. get a successful poem is even a better time. Or figure out a good or finish, get good results from an experiment. Mm-hmm. Brings me more joy, it's more enjoyable for me. But this, I observe it as a part of the craft, as a part of the duty, and basically I feel at ease, so to say, on the readings. And I think the importance of the reading is increasing, mm-hmm. Because first of all, it's an extension of the writing. It's another way how to convey your writing. For me, the writing is a communication. And so this is a real direct communication with the reader, which tells you a lot. And thirdly, I enjoy everything which I learned a little. Mm-hmm. Yes, I am very the most straining or most disagreeable thing for me is to do something which I really never learned properly. And I have the strong feeling. Maybe I have a strong sense of autocriticism. Mm-hmm. And I just figured out in these years, I am a very bad head of anything. I just am lost when I am supposed to conduct a meeting or a meeting of the board. I hate it. Because, no, I would like to do it. But I would enjoy it, but I feel I am not doing it well. Mm-hmm. And in the poetry reading, I have the feeling I am doing it well. I'm doing it moderately well in my standards and in the foreign language, so therefore finally the reply would be yes, I enjoy poetry readings.
Right.
And of course it's dependent on how many people there are, how you can communicate. Sometimes it's getting more rare now that you have not enough people and people with whom you can't move. The nice thing is that the people respond. It's not applauding, or it's just a little stir. It's just a little the ground noise which they make after some. The places in the poem which should cause the stir, and always you feel well when they didn't respond on the proper place. Something is wrong with the reading. So if everything works, so it's fine.
And you were saying about not enjoy, but if you learn something from the experience, then it's been worthwhile. Do you find criticism of your work, reviews of your books, at all useful, or are they irrelevant to you?
I'm sorry to say yes.
Irrelevant.
For a real important poet, usually hates the criticism and thinks that they are a bunch of idiots mm-hmm. who just didn't come across his noble message. And sometimes I have the feeling that he didn't get it. But always my first, really, I really mean it, it's very frank. My first concern is why didn't he get it? I wouldn't say others get it and this one reviewed, no. I always blame myself. It's maybe something wrong with my part.
How would you contrast that with the referees? Critics say of scientific papers.
Yes, and exactly, because I am trained by the very, very harsh criticism of the referees of scientific paper, who can afford to be much stricter because they stay anonymous. You never learn, or almost never learn, who the referee was. So sometimes you have very strict criticism. Sometimes you have a sort of mistaken criticism, that the referee wouldn't read it carefully, but you have to accept it. It's no other way. It's you have basically three referees for a scientific paper. Yes, no, and finally the editor-in-chief would say yes or no. And you have to accept it, you can't fight it. It's the most foolish to do something against it. But in literature, especially in our conditions, when somebody attacks you, so you immediately attack him. When somebody puts, as it says in Czech, puts you on a dog's head, that's a Czech saying. So you immediately retaliate, putting another dog's head on his, which is not an argument, of course, but that's the way it goes with the criticism. But I can't say I would hate a critic. I think I would rather hate myself.
You must have been a referee yourself, maybe even an editor of a journal.
I was, yeah.
Which was the name of the journal?
It's sort of a new scientist. It's like a new scientist. And I am refereeing, I am on some editorial board for scientific magazines, so I am refereeing too. And
do you also work as a critic for literature?
No, it's not my profession. As a sort of a scientific worker, you are qualified to refereeing other papers, provided you are on the board or you are invited. But I am not. I have no education and no in the humanities. So I never would dare to criticize something. I can just comment from the subjective point of view on somebody if asked, but I would rather not.
Mm-hmm. Can I get away with this question? I'd like to ask you two questions, and they're both from your own conversation with a poet. I'm sure you must have been asked this before, but could I beg you not to give the answers you've given the poet? And the questions are you a poet?
Yes.
And how do you know?
What's the question now?
The questions are simply, are you a poet? And how do you know?
Well, I have, yes. Using my own words, basically. I would say I was never sure. First of all, there are different kinds of poets. There are people who feel themselves as poets. And as you may know from the recent publications, a high percentage of the real poets are prone to develop some sort of neurosis or some sort of psychosis. The rate of the real poets, and I admire them, I must say, it's not a mocking of them, but there may be, with the real poet, there may be a special psychological disposition attached to the rate, in some of them, maybe. And I am definitely this kind of poet, because for scientific workers, the probability of the cyclic psychosis is even under the average, compared to normal population. So I think I am too normal to be a real poet. I would never label myself as a poet. I am somebody who tries to write poetry and hopes the next poem or the next collection of poems will be really good. That's the only thing which I have in common.
Well, you've been described by Alvarez as one of the sanest voices of our time. And for some poets, this might seem almost a disqualification.
Yes. Well, yes.
How does that work, that kind of remark?
That is a deeper sort of personal question involved. Is your life supposed to be sacrificed or lived? Yeah? I have the feeling that I would like to live my life than to sacrifice. There is one word which I really hate in the English language, is workaholic. I work most of my time by the book. I would hate even more than to be labeled a poet, to be labeled a workaholic. Because I think it's sort of a deviation. It's getting out of the normal human way. And basically our obligation, being born human, is to stay human and not to turn into some sort of black paranoid angel. So I still would never say I spent 16 hours a day working. I spent 88 hours a day working on this or that front, and the rest I spent just looking around, being, and especially what I like is playing.
Do you regard the poetry as work or play then?
Yeah. For me, with Craig Rehn, we already offended some poets with our statement that for us the poetry is basically a game. It's a play. Of course, a very serious play. But I would say the humans are the only zoological species who basically play in the adult life. For us, especially in poetry, we try to repeat our childhood. This is something very childish about poetry. Starting with the full concentration of the play and ending with the joy, with the sensation of the joy from the poem. But that's basically, it's a childish play, it's a game. And we are the only zoological species to come back which uses the play as an adult activity. For any cat, for any tiger, for any elephant, the play is the preparation for adult life, which is struggle, fight for survival, for food and so on. But we use the game because we got rid of this animal connections, for these animal relations to our environment. So we are the only playing animal.
Do you enjoy do you like Italo Calvino's work at all?
Yes.
He's very playful and yes. Also his kind of wide
knowledge. I like everybody. You know, I like everybody. As I said yesterday on a discussion, I like everybody who didn't become a statue of himself. Mm-hmm. And the statues don't play. Mm-hmm. They are very serious. They take themselves seriously. And I would say I take science and poetry very seriously, but I don't take myself very seriously. Then again, therefore, I am would be not labeled, wouldn't like to be labeled a real poet. I'm just trying to do the best poetry I can. And it's a play.
Can I return to one of the first questions? You said at the reading last night, somebody asked you, how had your writing changed since 1989, or what you were writing about, and you said that you felt your subject was the same.
Yeah.
It was idiocy. Previously, there was one kind of idiocy, which was the regime, and then, but now there are many varieties of idiocy. I wonder if you could expand on that. I find it very interesting. Could you?
Well, it's. I think it was already enough of a definition. Mm-hmm. We had, of course. On all sides of the political life or of the human life in the totalitarian regime, you have the dull people and smart people and so on. But in the totalitarian system, you have the tremendous advantage that the reigning, the establishment stupidity is so dominant that you can forget the others. They don't count so much. And basically you can feel even an ally of some sort of simple-minded people who may not be true, right, but they have the same issue. That means corrode the dominant stupidity. Even though you can corrode one stupidity with another stupidity. But in a free, open society, in a democratic society, you are concerned with all the possible deviations from a sane thinking. And to elaborate on the present situation at home, one of the feedbacks, one of the results of the former system is that the people started to go for all alternative ways of activities of thinking. When science as such experimental science or basic research existed in the communist regime, so something must be wrong in this instinct, even with the basic research. It must be some alternative way how to acquire knowledge, which is of course a nonsense. But the nonsense follows from the conditions, because you didn't have a choice, and now you have a choice. So people will believe they have an immense number of choices, but basically we still must live to survive in a modern world, technological world. We must be very disciplined, and we have not so many choices. Crossing the street, you don't have many choices. I noticed here, I was just living a year in Berlin. People feel free when they can cross the street on the red, even just running in between the cars and so on. But that's the same feeling as I speak metaphorically at home. That's the freedom. But for me, it's not the freedom. I am very glad when I have a reasonable way of crossing with a non-collapsed light system. I usually startle, especially in America, people saying, for me, freedom means basically observing the rules, provided the rules are being put rationally and they got a common concept, sort of a theoretical concept. But then, in a practical life, these rules apply. And not observe the rules is anarchy, not freedom. And that's the issues which we are under the surface face at the moment.
I'd like to ask you a question about kindness, which seems to link with what you've just been saying. You've said in an essay, The Dimension of the Present Moment, only through kindness can exams in biochemistry like life itself become memorable. And through the kindness of your examiner, you achieved a B-. That outlook on kindness is wonderfully refreshing. Yeah. In an age of ethnic cleansing on one hand and talk of a new world order on the other. I was just wondering what mark you would give the human race.
What
mark would you give the human race?
Kindness. Well, again, I would divide it. There are very many kinds of the human. There is nothing like a human race. Basically, if you take a sort of an abstract notion of human race, I would say this is a kind race. It's not an aggressive.
Would you give it an A plus?
Not A plus. I would say, let's say a B plus. And with A plus, it would be end of evolution. You can't do it. I would put it at B plus. But basically, that's again coming back with my definition of petrifying of the petrifying dignitaries. The petrified dignitaries are not kind anymore because of the stone. Even some stones feel more kind than the petrified dignitary. But the people who manage to be still human, with all the human connotations, for good and for bad, they can be kind. I just met Allen Ginsberg. Well, who can be, in terms of poetry, a most notorious poet, a famous poet, popular poet? And of course, yes, all kinds of his weaknesses and so on, but he stayed a kind person, and he does it, and he doesn't play it, and therefore I was just the opposite of his poetry, of himself. He was the last of the San Francisco poets whom I would feel affiliated with. I was always feeling affiliated with Ferlinghetti, or even with Schneider, but not with Ginsberg. But I like so much about Ginsberg that he stayed a very human, warm being. Even in the reading. He reads with some humor, with some sort of self-criticism. Actually, in Cheltenham, he was just doing one of the songs with his sort of harmonium, I don't know how to call this instrument, and he would just hit a wrong key. And then after two lines, he would say, no. Start again. usually one would try to hide it and just to change the tune. And, but he just stopped him in a sort of a student way and said, oh, no, no, sorry. Started again. So that's the times. And I think I take kindness as a very broad quality, which may not serve any purpose. There is something about being human, means that we are not behaving in human relations with sort of a biological purposefulness. We are in some, especially in the culture, we should be subjected to another kind of Darwinian selection, which are not the aggressive or the forces for survival, they are the forces of kindness. And in some situations we are really selected for forces of kindness. And I like all establishment, all kinds of human meetings, which would select or put a pressure on being simply human in this sense. This not to display all your colors, but just to display the proximity with people.
So this is an aspect of what Richard Dawkins calls memes, isn't it?
Yes.
In selection in a social situation.
Yes. Yeah.
There isn't a question in that. It's just interesting to hear somebody talking about those aspects in poetry interview.
Yes, and even I would say in my poetry, sometimes I miss the kindness. It is just my what I put would like to put my internal pressure on myself is exactly in the terms of kindness, because I still didn't learn to be sort of warm and kind enough. I must always suppress some sort of a pedagogic or stern approach to all the things, topics, and people in myself.
I would have thought it was a very unusual quality. Kind. Italo Calvino seems a very kind writer,
yes,
to me. And also your own work, apart from the fact you've written about it explicitly, it's in the poetry, but that's quite an unusual quality in the 1990s as a literary quality, I would say. It's unusual.
Well, I think it's an unusual quality, but still one can have personal proximities. And actually, I was very much influenced, not by poets in this sense, but by the scientist essayist Louis Thomas, who is by definition a very kind person, personally when you meet him, and in his writing. And always I feel the Louis Thomas essay is something more soft, more warm, and my essays feel to, even to me, a little more stony or colder or something, or more these edges.
It's an interesting correlation, actually, because one of the things I find in my ill at easeness, being ill at ease about poetry and science as a scientist and writing poems, is how both his work, Lewis Thompson's work, and your own, someone like Stephen Jay Gould, doesn't just release a knowledge inside myself, but it also releases what could be called kindness inside myself. It's held back otherwise. The writing has a quality that is there. Could I ask you a couple of specific questions that personally I'd like to hear answers to? And that's about, I know that you've been asked about poetry and science 686 times, and I'm not going to repeat that. Anybody who's read the last essay and this, you've given most of the answers. I'm after sidelong glances. What was your experience of education in pre-war Pilsen? I'm asking this because you've seen that system under communism, and you have a knowledge of systems in other parts of the world. Were you ever taught, as in my experience in the UK, to feel any sharp disparity between scientific training and the arts?
It's a very important note. I had what we call classical gymnasium. It means high school with the Greek and Latin as my main subjects. And even I had a great luck to have a professor of Greek who was he's a young man that time, he died meanwhile. He had only one arm. And he taught us in within the lessons of Greek language, Greek grammar, reading Homer, reading all kinds of Greek texts. In addition, he taught us Greek philosophy, the Hylozoists, and he taught us a sort of a Greek geometry and the basics of the Greek science, which was marvelous. Actually, in these lessons, it was all one culture.
Yes.
And he was a memorable personality, and education so much depends on the personalities. We can't have a better school system before we have a greater percentage of personalities of the teachers. I feel that the only thing which one can do about education is to have good teachers, and I had even in university some memorable personalities who would not show you how stupid you are as a student, but would be kind to you and show push you ahead. And that's what usually what personality is. That's again again coming back to the status. When you have the status as the teachers, so in any system it's hopeless, because they would just show how bigger they are than yourself. And I had on the university, in the high school, I mentioned this one teacher, but we had more of these. We had a mathematician who was basically, again, a mathematician, we teaching theoretical physics, and in the same time, he was a musician. He was the smartest guy I have met up to all my young years. Professor Spelder was the name. And again, he was the one culture man. He was an active musician. He was reviewing all musical events in my native town of Pilsen. And he was a very educated mathematician and physicist. And I must say, it was even more impressive because I was good in languages, I was good in natural history, but I was always had some troubles with mathematics. The only one, the D or something, what it is, which I ever got was being examined from mathematics, which was in the 8 years of the gymnasium, sort of an inner collapse for me to get a D. And then I improved, but I had always some troubles with Professor Spelder. And still, even more impressive, this personality was for me. And then on the university, I had some outstanding teachers who actually never taught us. I had a physiologist, Professor Lauberg, who never actually taught the human physiology or the general physiology. He just, most of the time, he developed his personal theory on nervous impulses. But he was dominated by the theory, it was his obsession. And a man who is not again getting oversized over his life size, and still is obsessed with his theory, is something memorable. Even the less gifted student must be impressed with such a personality. So this was another example, which and he was always trying to persuade us about his theory, and trying to persuade a student, a medical student, about hermetic theory is inviting. It's a very kind thing, because basically he could have read something, the basics of physiology, and forget us. I had a professor of surgery, Professor Jirase, who actually never lectured on surgery. He always would bring, it was almost a theatrical act, he would bring a patient on a stretcher, or an amputated leg, or a tumor in a dish, and make a lecture on these topics. And it was a surgery of the knee, and another time it was the abdominal surgery, another time it was a brain surgery. It didn't have any coherence, but we will never forget it. And again, he was speaking with us, which was the kindness. he would speak with us as with colleagues, not with the dull students. That was the essence of education. So basically I was very, very lucky with this education. I was already in my the high school years and in my university years, in spite of the conditions. It was still mostly in the till 48 before the communists took over. Then most of these professors lost their jobs or were replaced by some typical mediocre teachers trying to teach it. But these didn't try to teach it. They
conveyed their enthusiasm,
to convey their
and passions.
Yeah, their passions. So I was lucky to have this kind of education.
I guess that in my own experience, that's what it defaults from, is the personality of the teacher.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was going to ask you was basically to, if one somehow, in a barbaric way, takes the personality out of education, were there any concrete criteria that you could suggest? I mean, it's this business about being at ease, which you mentioned before.
Yeah.
In that essay, Poetry and Science, you have this thing that says, science has to say everything. Art, which would say everything, would be in its own grave. And what astonishes me about your life is the ease of which you feel within what we still call the two cultures, and what Medawar, you quote, calls an idiotic debate. But nevertheless, British culture is still debating it. And this makes me, as a science-trained individual who writes the poem, still ill at ease. And I just wonder if you had, from your perspective, some almost a concrete criterion by which we could achieve the same acceptance and the same needs.
Caused in the United States and here by a good established, that means by the very interesting, very intensive university career through which you are deeply embodied in the community, in your type of school, in your type of college, and hardly have time to move to another time. We had, in our times, we had much more free. As I said yesterday, I was more or less, even as a medical student, I had time enough to listen to Professor Patočka, the philosopher. Mm-hmm. Albeit he was a phenomenologist, I don't understand what it was about. I still, however I studied Husserl, I couldn't get simply to the essence of this. I think I admired the thinking, but I am not sure I know what it is about. It's exactly Einstein, my colleague Einstein, said the same thing. Whenever I hear philosophy, I feel I have to swallow something which I didn't have on my tongue. That's exactly the feeling. But we have been free to move from one culture to another and back. Mm-hmm. And under condition in the totalitarian system, you feel more or less on one ship. As I spoke about the class struggle, all people...
Professors are usually very frequent. The personalities I spoke about, sort of very human, very kind people. And the teaching, creative writing is interesting. It's like teaching physics or exactly like teaching philosophy or linguistics. It's basically a very direct contact between the professor and the student. I think the best creative writing courses include as many individual conferences as possible. And I did it already in three instances in the States, and last summer I did it in Prague in the so-called Central European University. And it's much easier for me to do it in Prague because I have the backing of the city, of the Schweik or Kafka or whatever city or Havel's city. It was for American students because it was expensive and no Czech student or no Czech writer could have afforded it. But the connection is real. In the best way of creative writing, there is a very direct connection between the writer and the student. And the teaching is both ways. You get a lot from the imagination of the student, of the system of thinking of the student, as he may eventually get from you. So basically, I have a positive attitude to the creative writing.
It's totally changed direction.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Sure.
Between 1970 and 1980,
yeah.
You became effectively a non-person,
yes.
signing a petition.
Yeah.
There are various questions I've got around this, which I'll give at once, because the answer yeah. that you give back is probably going to contain these things. I just wondered how do you know you've become a non-person, and when do you know you've become a person again, in a physical sense? With the physical mechanisms and the physical strategies?
It's through a very concrete situation. I became a known person because I was called to the publishing house where my book on Edgar Allan Poe was supposed to appear, and I was directly told by a good-willing and friendly man, not a party or something, well, you're from now on, you can't be named, your name, as so many other, must disappear, but the book must appear because it cost us 600,000 crowns. So you must accept that the book will appear with your name. So from the moment I thought I knew I am a non-person. Mm-hmm. I was a non-person that even you mentioned the petition. It was a petition which I never wrote. It was a police provocation. But I was a non-person. I had a very little defense.
So it wasn't.
So now I was a double non-person.
Yeah.
Even not only not writing, but even writing some things which I didn't write. So it was a double negation of the existence. And then it was a check way because no rules would be very stable in the Czech national mood, I would say. So when the times were even the bosses were a little more relaxed. I wouldn't say it would be a liberation. Immediately, the editors would sense it. And one day, in maybe 80, I would be called by a friendly editor who was actually, he was a memorable man, he died. Because we, as students, we took part in a poetry and prose competition. And we both were sort of shortlisted and won the first and third prize. In poetry and in essays, it was both again. And I never had seen a band, but he remembered me, and I remembered his name, and he suddenly called me to a publishing in the South and saying, look, we may now find a way how to publish these unknown persons, but he had a beautiful definition. He called it Jivel, that is the translation of Jivel. It's like wind, fire, air, water. What do you
mean?
Elements. Yeah. But we can very, very well. We can publish one elephant per year. So we will start with the great Czech poet, Moravian poet Skácel, or you. What do you think? And I said, well, let's start with Skácel because he is older, and secondly, he needs it because I still was in the laboratory. And the Skácel was nowhere. So he started with Skácel. Next year it was me, and it was one element per year. And that's the check. And finally, you know, the bosses, the senders or something, they get tired. They say, when you insist, when you use the strategy, which was a very Czech strategy, or our strategy, the Gutarka Vatlapidem, that means the water would excavate the stone, not by force, but for frequent falling. They would give up. If you ask them the same question or put them before the same problem, they would say no 5 times, but not 15 times. And that was the essence. So we came back to the literature, and finally the situation was that almost, with the exception of the full dissidents, like Havel, even Klima would have been already published without the breakthrough, without the revolution. Most of them, actually, I have seen in 88 the program of one publishing house, and there was already a Kundera, as an attempt. Again, the authorities would say, no, of course, Kundera not. And the next year they would say, well, Kundera not. And the third day, it's all of that. So that was the policy.
Well, you're now living in the Czech Republic. I'm going to quote a poem that you read after the question, one of your own. I was wondering how the revolution has affected matters for younger poets, and if you found that there is a mood of optimism among them. I'm thinking of Wenceslas Square's syndrome.
Yeah,
where you say this song of the only December schizophrenic blackbird, mighty everlasting song of the only schizophrenic blackbird. Yes, of course, a song.
Yeah, but it's 1988. Yes. I had to put the
whispers.
Day.
Yeah.
They have been there, the young poets, with the exception of the full dissidents. Had the greatest possibility to be printed than they have now. They would be still introduced in the readings. There was a heavy, intensive program of readings for the young ones, and they have been almanacs of the new poetry. Sometimes in one period they had a beautiful name of Green Feathers. Green Feathers. And nowadays it's very hard to publish it. So many of the young, not only poets, but artists are growing a little sour about it. It was a program of the Australian ABC television track, and they interviewed a couple of young artists, and all would say, I was the only optimistic guy on the program. He would say, well, of course, the real artist will survive all the adversities, all the economic pressures, and all the dangers of the consumer society and commercial culture coming in. But most of the young artists would say, well, we are very disappointed with the with a playwright as a president. We hope we will be supported. But that's the price of freedom. It's a foolish expectation. We all had a foolish expectation that the good Western capitalists would immediately support our economy. Of course, they are more or less suppressing it. Because especially for the weaker economies, this is a competition. We can't produce as much steel as we could. We can't export as much meat as we could because of the EC regulations. And again, that's the price. And the price for the that the poet can say what he is supposed to, what he wants to say, the price is as here, but nobody would print it, or nobody would read it. So they had to... the complaint is only one thing, to do something against it. That means, for instance, to try to be more comprehensive. That's another thing. I know, saying it, I am trying to, I would like to go on with my sort of a surrealistic place, which you have in the end of the poems before and after. So that means poems written as a sort of an end game, as a play, as a script for a play. It amuses me. I like it because it's sort of a slight innovation, of course. Jacques Prévert did it already, but for me it's a slight innovation still. But I think it's incomprehensible. So I again write these more or less transparent, short, more digestible poems, just to stay close to the eventual readers who still survive in good proportions. I would say the potential reader of poetry per capita is still not such a rare animal in our conditions. But we have to approach him. We have to attract him. Not just to be as much post-communist, post-modernist as possible. As I always say, the post-communist, post-modernist is much, much harsher than the simple post-modernism, because it's a post-modernism is a personal touch. It's a personal mission. Modernism was communist, and now we have post-communist, anti-communist, post-modernism. It's all kinds of ideological and structural, minimalistic, or other features in the poetry. But it's not palatable for the plain people.
That's different than, say, in Britain or America. I mean, post-modernism normally means a more relaxed attitude towards modernism, not worrying. I mean, I think of a postmodernist as a modernist who no longer worries about the modern. It's taking pleasure in difference and variety, and it's not so fraught as Eliot or... but you're talking about having to come to, in the Czech Republic, writers having to come to terms with modernism and communism, or post-communism. That seems like a different definition of postmodernism.
Well, Definitely, it's the postmodernism is in all by all means and in all attitudes anti-ideological, anti-simple sort of a philosophical construction of the world, usually concerned more or less with the phenomenological approach, more or less with the sort of the French Derrida attitude towards truth, towards knowledge. That means a skeptic, heavy relativism and skepticism.
Also
the sentence is what counts, the speech is what counts, not the message. The message.
And taking pleasure in that, Roland Barthes.
Yes, taking pleasure, but I wish that it could be more pleasure included in the modernism. The postmodernism. The postmodernism turns into something which is very priest-like again. Mm-hmm. I think they are taking themselves extremely seriously.
You said you'd like people to read your poems or to read poetry in the same as naturally as they would go to a football match.
This was a juvenile dream.
It's a nice idea.
It can't be done, but still, it could be the direction. It could be the direction, not to be as the direction would be to be as comprehensible as possible in the given system, in the given head, and to use the aesthetic qualities which can be shared by other people. And one of the main aesthetic qualities in modern present day writing is the humor. And we have a great education in a political joke. We survive by joking. And I even suspect that something which we have in common, the English, speaking countries, and Czechs, especially the Czechs, is the way of joking. We have the same, the English way of joking, which is strange how it could develop, because we never had any ties with England. And suddenly after the war, and I suspect it was sort of a political condition because of English, be it from BBC or from Radio Free Europe, was the voice of freedom. So suddenly the English language, even before the heavy commercial, industrial, technical pressure, scientific pressure, because our language is colonized by English expressions, of course, as everywhere. We had some inner, very deep links with the English world, English way of thinking. Even before the way before 89, and I would say just after the war, we started to shift culturally, I would say aesthetically and emotionally, to the English-speaking world from Paris. It can't be just a chance that so many the best translators translated American English poetry. And we have, since the war, in the last 4 years, with all the communists around, we have four big anthologies of American poetry, three big anthologies of British poetry, in addition to single poets, like From Ted Hughes to Galway Kinnell, being published in single volumes, and in addition to a special magazine which publishes only translated literature. So we had almost everybody, even the younger poets, already translated. And I would submit, maybe I am mistaken, we know more about the British poetry or American poetry than we know about the French poetry. There was only one anthology, if I remember good, of the French poetry, only one anthology of Italian poetry, couple of anthologies from German poetry, but the most translated literature is the Anglo-American literature, and it must have some reason.
Are there any modern British poets who you enjoy particularly?
I enjoy. I always liked, and I was much impressed by Ted Hughes in whatever he writes, and I know Tony Harrison. I know very well Anthony Clay, and I like his writing. I like a lot Galway Kinnell, as I said already, Ferlinghetti from the Americans. and so on. So I have many persons, and usually in general, when I read anybody in England or America, I could translate it. Because I have the feeling, this 8 opera dictionary, I understand it. When I read anybody from the French, old or young, I have the feeling I couldn't translate it because I really don't know what he means. Because the French style still nowadays is very academic and very abstract compared to your and to ours. There is a considerable part of the Czech young present literature again attracted back to Paris, which is more or less going closer to the French poetic system. But this is only a part. But definitely my part is much more closer. And I was amazed, basically, how different the literatures the poetic context are, by seeing my French book, which may be now in print. The selection of the Czech translator living in Paris, a very good man, extremely skilled in both languages, did something which is just overlapping with the poems before and after, about like this. It's almost an other image of the so-called poet. He just would pick up just the poems which I wouldn't have translated into English. It's interesting how different the context is, and predilections for the French selection are just almost opposite to the predilections or the conditions for the English translation.
What would you say that English and Czech writers or people share then? Sense of irony, humor,
sense of irony, and concrete thinking, some kind of skepticism, some kind of sort of cold-faced, but in a way warm-hearted cynicism. These are qualities, and not exactly the French kind of the subtle lyricism.
Have you had the time or the opportunity yet to metabolize some of the new British and Irish power poets who are represented in...
No, I did
not protest the new poetry.
No, I haven't seen it.
David's not saying he's actually one of the editors of the, of the book. He's got.
But, please, take a copy.
I know Konstantin. I know Durkan.
Yes. Have you read with him?
Yes.
Was that in Hull? Did you read with Durkan in Hull?
Yes.
I remember that.
Yeah. Well, I am sure I will... that's again the feeling what I already said. I am sure I will find to very many related voices.
Well,
and I would be not sure, so sure about the Czech selection. I was amazed by figuring out very related voices in the Slovakian poetic representation present, and I would be sure I would be almost lost in a French selection. I know of the young French poets very. Still, Ponge would be closer to my heart than the present-day writer. And it's simply another mentality. You may remember when a French poet reads something, he always insists to read at length in French, which is of course beautiful. But when you have 30 minutes of just French, it's getting monotonous, but he insists it's sort of a mess, it's sort of a poetic mess, what they usually do.
Could I take you to your new book, Pilsen?
Yes.
It's already out in your own homeland, and it's due here from Blood Act, according to Neil, next year?
Well, I don't know. Hey, I will have to...
send him the book.
I have to consider also a favor and favor. I don't know how to split it. The Pilsen book, actually, I told yesterday Neil Astley, it must be deeply considered because I like it because it's a mixture, it's a symmetrical mixture, prose poem, concerned with the city. It's not no geography, no history, not too much of the history of the city, it's just very personal. It's basically my childhood. Yeah? But he must decide how it works in English. So that's one possibility, but it wouldn't work fully without the photographs.
because the way our cities are, what they look now is the dilapidation and hope and new problems and new structures in the cities. That's a part of our both of our hopes and of our memories. Even the changing face of the cities, it's part of us. So needlessly we'll have to decide, and then after this decision I will see what to do in terms of the next paper and paper book. I would have enough new poems, but I don't like just to publish poems. We just, it is the single reason I have enough poems. It's not a reason for a book for me.
Who lived at 26 Station Road in Pilsen?
An old lady whom I saw, so really, I don't know the name. Actually, I came there later, because the ruins of the house were still standing, but there was no label on the door. It was just an old lady whom I had seen her from downstairs. She was just opening the door, there was nothing there. Very old lady. And the rest of the poem is of course fabricated. And it's omitted that nearby there were a sort of remnants of a Czech policeman who was killed during the air raid. And I was supposed to be killed in this air raid because I was supposed to be exactly on the railway station. But I was lazy and I was starting from home too late. And when I was still underway, the bombs started falling, so I simply returned home. But the meeting point that I was supposed to be was got a direct hit by a bomb. So being delayed was my way of survival. I'm sorry to say, nowadays I'm always at time. So nowadays I wouldn't survive anymore.
I'm asking questions now. There are questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay. But you might